you ever heard of digital currencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and buzzwords like blockchain, cryptocurrencies, and mining? Don't know what it all means or how to get started? Well, at Let's Talk Crypto, we break it all down in easy-to-understand terms and help you learn and earn in the age of cryptocurrencies. So welcome to the Let's Talk Crypto Show, brought to you by SchoolOfCrypto.com with your hosts, Barry Moore and Tom Galeski.
Welcome back, listener, to the Let's Talk Crypto podcast. We're into 2018, and I hope you guys had an awesome festive season New Year's break. The crypto market wasn't sleeping, relaxing, having eggnog and champagne. It's been up and up and up, and over $100 billion in coin market cap since our last recording. So welcome to 2018. This is Tom Galeski here, and with my awesome co-host, Barry Moore. How are you, buddy?
Hey, brother. Glad to be back for 2018. This is going to be another crazy year, I'm sure.
Yeah, mate, looking forward to it. As I said in the last episode, I'm strapped to the front seat of this crypto roller coaster, and it's going to be awesome. Looking forward to it. In our Facebook group, we've had a few questions that we're going to be tackling today. One of the core topics and one of the common questions we get asked quite often is the difference between proof of work and proof of stake. So in today's episode, we'll be discussing what the key differences are, why it is important to understand them, and how this can affect crypto moving forward.
Awesome. Let's get into it.
All right, so the first thing we'll go through is what we call the proof of work. Proof of work is what Bitcoin uses and provides the security around the actual protocol itself. We have a lot of noise out there and people talking about proof of work, which is what Bitcoin is based on. Now, we've also heard a lot of the terminology around miners. Miners are the key to secure the network and validate the transactions. Barry, do you want to dig a little bit deeper on the proof of work concept?
Yeah, so basically what proof of work works off of is, in order to solve a transaction and complete a block, the miners have to do a complex mathematical problem. Just like when you were standing up in, you know, in front of algebra class and you had to go through the whole equation to figure out the solution to a problem. You had to show your work. Teachers always used to say, show your work. Once you've shown your work and you've come to the conclusion and you've come to the answer, it's easy for everybody else to go reach consensus and say, yes, that's the right answer. So, for example, if I had your ATM card, but I didn't have your PIN, I could go up to the ATM, put your card in, go 0000, enter. Nope, that's not your PIN. 0001, not your PIN. 0002, not your PIN. 003, et cetera, all the way through to 9999 until I found your PIN. Now, that would be a pain in the ass. It would probably take me about 16 hours to go through every single combination. But once I found your PIN, 8372 or whatever it is, everybody else could validate that in a split second because they could walk up and punch it in and go, yep, that's the one. So there's a lot of work involved in solving the problem. There's no work involved in validating that that was the correct answer. So the miners are busy trying to solve these complex mathematical cryptographic problems. But once they're solved, all the other miners can agree that, yes, that was the right answer for that particular problem. And then the transaction is validated. The transactions go into a block. The block is then appended to the blockchain. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. And the difficulty algorithm is adjusted to make sure that transactions happen at a constant rate. So for example, if everyone starts flooding the market with newer, smarter miners and the transactions are happening like every 2 minutes, the difficulty algorithm will go up to slow down the amount of transactions to make so that they aren't too easy. And then if all the transactions slow down, then the algorithm makes the transaction problem easier. So that the real world example of that would be going from a 5-digit PIN code or a 6-digit PIN code rather than a 4-digit PIN code. It would be take a lot more time to figure out what the correct combination is. Or if it's taking too long, I could go to a 3-digit or a 2-digit or a 1-digit PIN code. It would be much easier. So the difficulty algorithm goes up and down based on how hard the transactions need to be to kind of keep things constant. So, and there's a lot of money at stake because the miners who solve these are getting a reward of new Bitcoin. New Bitcoin springs into life as a reward for doing those problems or solving those blocks. So whoever solves the blocks gets rewarded with new Bitcoin. So these miners are doing this, all this work, because there's money in it. They're the ones to solve a block. They get what's called the block reward. And at the moment, the time of recording, it's about 12.5 Bitcoin, which is a pretty considerable amount of money if you convert that back to US dollars. So there's a big incentive to be the guy or to be the one that solves that block or wins that block, as they say. So that's why you see these miners throwing heaps of computing power at these problems. If you go just Google Bitmain mining factory, for example, you'll see what the giant scale, like 25,000 miners in these 8 warehouses, and that's just one site. So it's a huge, huge business, and it's become an arms race. You know, in the early days, you could mine with a CPU and solve a block, and then people moved to graphics processing units, and then you had to have GPUs, so they would solve it faster than the CPUs. And then you're using multiple GPUs in a big rack. And then we went to ASICs, which are designed specifically just to do nothing else but crack these Bitcoin transaction problems. So it's an arms race to who can have the most powerful hardware. And then the second part of that equation is the electricity that goes into powering all these miners. And then, so the second part of that arms race is who can have the cheapest power, right? So if you have the smartest computing power and the cheapest electricity, you're probably going to win more blocks. So it has really becomes an arms race, and it's kind of put mining, at least for Bitcoin, out of the hands of kind of ordinary people. I know Tom's a big miner, but all these coins that you mine, quote unquote, you mine, are using a proof of work algorithm. So Tom, what are the other, some of the other coins that use proof of work?
The ones that I have experience with, things like Ethereum, you know, Ubik, Psycoin. I mean, there's over 1,300 coins. So there's a ton of coins out there that you can set up in your home on a GPU-based miner and actually mine these things as well. We won't go too deep on all the mining and all the different types of algorithms. The next few weeks, we'll have a dedicated episode for mining because I know it's very much a question in our group, so we'll definitely get to that moving forward. I don't want to get too technical on that now, but it is coming soon. If you want to have any specific questions answered, please go to our School of Crypto group on Facebook. Add some comments in there and we'll see if we can answer your specific questions on that episode coming up very soon.
Yep. And the easy way to find that is just to go to schoolofcrypto.com/Facebook. It'll redirect you exactly to the right place. Tom, let's talk about some of the pros and cons of proof of work. So what are some of the pros?
A few of the pros of the proof of work is that, first of all, it's the longest type of algorithm that exists out there. We found that it's never been hacked to this day. In saying that, the whole idea of this decentralized mining is that a recent stat that I read was if you add up all the mining that exists on the planet right now, it's using over $1 million per day just in electricity and energy costs. So the whole theory of the proof of work is you've got all these miners scattered all around the world that are mining these puzzles to try and solve them. The theory behind that is it's to avoid what we call a 51% attack. What that means is if someone wants to modify the blockchain, they have to have over 51% of the computing power to be able to go through and modify that block. Now, we talk about the blockchain, which is made up of blocks. Well, every block in the blockchain refers to the block prior. So if you wanted to modify something in the blockchain, you have to have enough computing processing power, enough energy, and to do the whole thing in less than 10 minutes. But you need over 51% of the processing power and energy to be able to reverse that current block before it's written to the blockchain. Because after 10 minutes goes through, it adds it to the blockchain, you now need to go back to 2 blocks. So it's financially prohibitive for anyone to actually do that because of the pure cost involved in not just the hardware, but the energy and electricity costs. That makes proof of work a solid foundation.
Exactly right. And as Tom said, it's been around the longest. It's been tried and tested for years with Bitcoin. There are also varying levels of proof of work, as we talked about. So some of the coins, as we talked about, will use ASIC-resistant mining so that you don't have to have the super expensive computers to do that. But we'll talk about that in our mining episode. So some of the cons behind proof of work as a system, as Tom said, it's a massive suck of electricity and energy. So if you, you know, that's $1 million a day in electricity costs, you know, that's kind of wasteful. And if you couple that with all the energy and resources it goes into building thousands upon thousands upon thousands of ASIC miners, the little computers that are doing this, that really have no other use in the real world other than just solving hash problems for Bitcoin, that's a lot of time, resource, energy that gets wasted. Now, some people would argue, well, that's where the kind of the proof and the value is in Bitcoin and that it can't be easily hacked. And I totally get that, but it's not terribly environmentally friendly. And then the second con I think we could talk about is what we're starting to see this, especially in Bcash. There are, you know, since these miners are so expensive and these giant mining pools are starting to monopolize the mining of a lot of these coins, whereas, you know, these ASIC miners, they're the ones that create them. They're the ones that owns the factories to build the ASIC miners. Then they turn around, put them into their own mining pool. It's getting very centralized amongst a few large mining pools. so that the miners have an undue amount of influence over potentially over the network. So what used to be very egalitarian in that everybody could mine from their desktop computer at home, now it's centralized around a few players with a lot of money to build and manage these hardware things. So there are some concerns around centralized mining, especially with ASICs in Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash. I think if you look at some of the mining pools around Bitcoin Cash, I think if you the top three miners got together and colluded, they would have over 51% of the hash power for the Bitcoin Cash network, which is not great.
Yeah, another point, Barry, as well, because at the end of the day, as you're mining, you're getting paid rewards. In this case, we're talking about Bitcoin, right? But you're getting currency for doing the mining. So as the allocation of Bitcoin or the currency reduces over a period of time, it'll reduce the amount of rewards that are coming into the ecosystem. So that may then may allow the miners to switch to another coin or to another algorithm. So that would essentially put some pressure. It's definitely a price pressure, meaning that, you know, it's no longer profitable for me to mine that coin. So I'm going to switch all my mining to this one. And that also takes out the resourcing or the security or the proof of work will actually slow down. And that could have an impact then on obviously fees and all other things that are associated with that coin.
So now that we've talked about proof of work and some of the drawbacks of proof of work, like it's not very environmentally friendly, it's being centralized around miners who can afford this expensive mining equipment, etc. Some of the coins have moved to a different system, which is called proof of stake. So there are a number of different flavors of proof of stake. So and will depend, it will vary a little bit from coin to coin. But basically what proof of stake is, it's just a consensus algorithm that decides who should mine the next block. Or they don't call it mining, they call it forging or minting. Who should mint the next block? How's it going to be produced? What's the reward involved? How do we make changes to the protocol if we want to make changes to it? And how is the competition for new transactions, how is that resolved? So proof of stake doesn't rely on expensive hardware, and it doesn't rely on necessarily solving a mathematical problem. So we take out the environmentally friendly concerns of all these computers and all this electricity goes away. You can do proof of stake on normal desktop hardware. But what proof of stake basically says is, in order to get rewarded for validating transactions on the system, you have to put up some money first to show us you're serious. So just like if you want to go play a poker game and they said, oh, the minimum buy-in is, you know, $20,000 to play at this table, that's your stake to play the game. So if you want to be somebody who gets rewarded for validating transactions on some coin's network, you've got to pony up a bunch of coins and lock them away so that you can't touch them. But that makes you a proof of stake person, essentially, on that network. And you now have the chance to earn rewards for validating transactions. So your computer's running 24/7. It's potentially validating transactions and safeguarding the ledger. And you get rewarded for that. So instead of a mining reward, you're getting a transaction fee, essentially. So there's a couple of different types of proof of stake, but basically it's a concept where a person can mine or validate a block of transactions according to how many coins he or she may hold. So for example, there are staking coins where if you put, you know, 10,000 coins in your wallet, you can now get rewards for staking those coins on the network. So that's proof of stake. He who puts the most money in gets the most rewards or has a chance to get the most rewards. There's delegated proof of stake, which I'll talk about in a second. And there's also kind of least proof of stake. And then there's another concept called masternodes. So masternodes we'll talk about in another episode as well. But how proof of stake works, as I said, you put the coins in. You identify yourself as wanting to stake those coins. So they're locked away. You are then available as a person who could get a reward for validating transactions. So when you're chosen to validate a transaction by whatever consensus algorithm chooses that, you will be given a reward, a transaction fee, basically. So a number of new coins will spring into your wallet. And so essentially you're making money for safeguarding the network and having a certain amount of coins locked away. Now that amount of coins varies from currency to currency. So delegated proof of stake works a little bit differently. They have somebody called either a witness or a validator or a masternode or something like that. The terms vary from coin to coin, but let's just say a validator. So you have a validator on the network who is validating transactions, and that may cost the fee to be a validator or the amount of coins you have to lock away. It might be pretty prohibitive for most people. It might be like 100,000 coins, for example. But what you can do is you can, even if you've got 500 coins or 1,000 coins or whatever, you can vote for who you want to be your validator. So it's kind of like democracy in action. So if I know Tom, I like Tom, I trust Tom, but I don't have enough to be a validator myself, I can say, I want Tom to represent me in the validation stakes on this network. So the more coins he gets, the more votes he gets, the higher up the validation tree he gets, and he has a better chance of earning rewards. If he starts making decisions about the network that I don't like, I can take my voting power away from him, and he drops back down, and he might drop out of the stakes to get rewards for that particular coin as well. So the idea there is if that person is not acting in the best interest of the network, they can basically be ostracized by the rest of the people in the network. They no longer get any rewards. Also, if these people who are staking, the validators or the witnesses, if they're acting in a manner that hurts the network, those coins that they have locked up can be taken away. So you may lose your stake that you put into the game. So if you put 100,000 coins in to be a witness or a validator, it's probably in your best interest not to lose those 100,000 coins, right? So there is kind of an inherent safeguard to the system where people will kind of always act in their own financial best interest. If I do something bad, I lose all my money and hurt the network, then I lose all my coins. And that's how it goes. And then there's the concept of leased, as in LEASED, leased proof of stake, where I don't really voting for somebody, I'd like to get some rewards myself, but I don't have enough to qualify for a node or to qualify to be a witness or a validator. What I can do is I can loan my 1,000 coins to somebody else and they'll be the validator for me, and I'm made up of a pool of all these other people who have leased their coins. And then when they get a reward, those rewards are spread across to everybody who's contributed to that lease pool of coins, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Barry, just to add to that, so with proof of stake, I mean, instead of burning all this energy for proof of work, right? So you're running a computer and what you're doing, is you're checking the rules for everybody else. Now, to get a little bit sort of granular on that, so every 10 minutes, what's happening is you're locking away a portion of your coins onto the chain. And that could be for 30 up to around 100 blocks. It does depend on the different coin or the currency. Now, while it stays locked, you continue to validate the rules, all right? So if you validate it correctly, you get your initial investment back and a portion of the fee. So that's how you actually get money from this thing or earn some more crypto. Now, if you validate incorrectly, meaning that you're trying to modify the transaction, you lose your coins. So rather than investing energy, you invest digital currency itself inside the system, which then proves that you're committed to checking the security of the rules and helping secure that network. So the incentive here is that if you're trying to cheat the system, you'll actually lose your initial investment. So while we talk about the security element and the 51%, so like with Bitcoin, so, you know, avoiding the 51% attack with all the processing and power out there, you need to actually hold over 51% of the coins of that currency. And if you did something that was untoward or incorrect, you would actually lose that investment. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for someone to buy over 51% of the coins, trying to do some funky stuff on the blockchain to actually then get reprimanded by losing that initial investment. So I think it's self-propagating, meaning that, you know, I don't think anybody would want to put an investment in, try and modify the blockchain, and then lose their initial investments. It doesn't make sense. So I like the proof of stake. I think it has potential for growth. And what we're seeing now, I'm sure Barry will touch on this in a second, is that as we go forward, we're starting to see hybrid systems where they have proof of work and proof of stake, and current coins out there that are switching from proof of work, moving to a proof of stake system once they work out some of the bugs and the kinks.
Yeah, exactly right. So Ethereum, for example, is now currently a mined coin. So they're working off proof of work. They're actively doing development to change that all over to proof of stake. They've got a Casper project running to change everything over to proof of stake once they figure out how to do it properly. And as Tom said, some coins run off a hybrid kind of system of both of those things. So a lot of the times these nodes or these validators or witnesses or masternodes, whatever you want to call them, are called masternodes. And you put in so many coins to become a masternode, and that allows you to validate transactions, safeguard the blockchain, if that coin is using a blockchain, safeguard the blockchain and get rewards for doing so. There are some hybrid systems like Dash where they still have miners. So miners get 45% of the block rewards, masternode owners get 45% of the block rewards. So it's kind of split. So it becomes even more difficult to attack the system, because now there's three different prongs you've got to attack to try and do something untoward. We will talk about masternodes in another episode because it is a pretty good opportunity to make money if you don't want to invest in all that expensive mining hardware, for example, to try and get some new coins. Masternodes are a pretty good way to do that. But when it comes down to proof of stake, obviously no system is perfect, so there are pros and cons to both. I guess some of the pros are that you don't need that really expensive hardware. So, you know, a brand new ASIC miner might cost you $4,000, $5,000, $6,000. And then you got to add electricity costs on top of that. So you're, you know, say it costs $1,000 a year in electricity, you're $7,000, $6,000 in the hole before you even start getting a single coin. So at least with proof of stake, you're actually buying the coin. And you have the coin and you don't need expensive hardware. You don't need cooling fans, you know, big electricity bills. You don't need any of that to get started. Also, the fact that these coins are locked up makes the currency a little bit more stable. It's not as volatile going up and down when all these kind of coins are locked away and they're not in the pool that's being bought and sold every day. It evens out the stability of the coin, potentially may lead to wider adoption of that coin. You can't use, for example, Bitcoin as a spending currency if it's going up and down 30% every week, right? So it helps even out those spikes. And one other pro of proof of stake is it's more environmentally friendly. You're not burning all that electricity for no particular reason, and you're not having big factories building computers that have no other purpose other than to do mining. It's also faster. It also can be faster in that you don't have 10-minute block times now because you don't have to solve this really complex mathematical problems. So the transaction speed can be much higher. If you look at things like Steam or BitShares, those transaction speeds are much, much higher. And this, so that means there's much more throughput and many more transactions per second. So those are some of the pros of proof of stake. Tom, what about some of the cons?
So by having all the currency tied up in a wallet, people aren't using it for everyday usage, which means it could lower its adoption rates because, like I said, people are staking their coins and earning money from their investment. And the way that the proof of stake algorithm works is that so the more coins that you have, the more rewards that you get. So the rich actually get richer. So the more coins you have in your initial investment, the more rewards that you get. So as an example, so if you hold 5% of a particular coin or currency, that means that you get 5% of the rewards of that coin or currency. So the more that you hold, the more rewards that you get.
Yes, and there is some criticism too that if it's one of these coins where it takes, you know, 100,000 coins to get it to be a validator or a witness or a masternode, for example, that puts it out of reach of the everyman, right? So cryptocurrency, you know, in its essence was designed to be democratic and egalitarian. Well, if it's, it costs 100,000 coins to set up a masternode, for example, that puts it out of the reach of most people. So whereas with mining, you know, anybody with a few thousand dollars can go buy a miner and start mining. So there is that only the rich can be a validator or a witness or whatever. But again, the consensus rules vary from coin to coin. So some coins will promote that kind of behavior and some coins will specifically have rules where make it easier for anybody with just a smaller number of coins, like Waves, for example. If you have 1,000 coins, you can put those into a lease pool like we talked about to do lease proof of stake. And at least you're getting some reward back for even having a small number of coins.
Yeah, great stuff, Barry. So maybe just to summarize, the two different types of coins, those that use the proof of work and mining hardware to solve complex cryptographic problems, which then basically safeguard the network, and then they get rewarded with new coins called block rewards. And then the other types of coins, which are the proof of stake or the POS, they're individuals that are staking a large number of coins to ensure security, and they get rewarded with newly mined coins or transaction fees straight back into their wallet.
Yeah, exactly right. So, and if you're curious to know what type of algorithm is used by a particular coin, there's a good site you can go to called coingecko.com. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But if you drill down, if you click on a particular coin, it will tell you what algorithm, whether it's proof of work, proof of stake. If it is proof of work, what hashing algorithm it uses, which we didn't really talk about, but I will talk about it in the mining episode. You can find all that kind of groovy information. You can even filter by ones that are show proof of stake or just show a particular mining algorithm. You can find that all over at coingecko.com.
Yeah, it's a great resource, Barry. I'm there occasionally having a poke around. So, mate, that brings this episode to an end. So, listeners, if you have any questions, please head over to schoolofcrypto.com and feel free to leave your feedback or comments. In the meantime, we would love it if you could subscribe or share. That helps our show get a wider reach and get more people involved in this wonderful rollercoaster ride of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. Talk to you soon, folks.
See everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Let's Talk Crypto Podcast. You can find the links, show notes, and all the latest cryptocurrency news over at schoolofcrypto.com.